Harold made kind of a name for himself, predicted that the end of the world was coming in September of 1994. He was wrong. And then he kind of went underground for a while. And then in early 2011, if you were watching the news, he was on the news a lot because it was just really fun. And he declared that May 21st, 2011 would be the day of the end of the world. He was wrong again. And so on May 22nd, he said that what really happened is that we all missed it. God judged the world on May 21st in the heavenly realms, and that we just didn't notice it here, and that we wouldn't actually see the results of that judgment. Apparently, it had to go through appeals. And we wouldn't see it until September of 2011. And so that didn't happen either. And then the day after that, the ministry radio station that he led fired him and then took all his teachings off the radio. Like, you can't find them online anymore. I guess they're all gone. So, and I don't mean to pick on him. He died a year ago. He's just the most famous in recent memory of lots of preachers throughout history who have declared this is when the end of the world is coming. And so that happens with regular frequency, and on the interwebs, you can find people like that all the time, and it's just really fun. Because the whole thing, where we're going to go to this morning, is if you want to turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 24, the parable that Ted just read is a story that Jesus tells after the teaching in Matthew chapter 24, where Jesus is really clear about this idea that we don't know when the end of the world is coming. And in fact, Jesus goes so far as to say the angels in heaven don't know. And by the way, I don't know either. But apparently some modern preachers do. So that's me being a little cynical. I'm sorry. I'm going to talk about cynicism at the end. I'll circle back and chide myself. So Matthew chapter 24, we're going to look at the passage that Ted just read in just a minute. But we're going to get a good running start onto it and up to it. And I'm going to read I'm going to read all of chapter 24 if that's okay. Is it okay to read scripture in church? Can I do that? I will do that. Thank you. So Matthew 24 is known as the Olivet Discourse. Matthew is structured. If you took the whole Gospel of Matthew, Matthew is structured around five discourses, five big teachings of Jesus. The most famous of those is the Sermon on the Mount. Thank you. In Matthew 5, 6, and 7. This is the last one, and we call it the Olivet Discourse because the first line of it, Jesus went up and sat down on the Mount of Olives, and that's where we get the title for it. And so I'm going to give you just a little bit of context, and then we'll get to it. Here we go. I'm going to skip this slide and just go this one. Matthew chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Now, obviously, they're in Jerusalem. This is the last week of Jesus. And they're drawing, just review here. The disciples are drawing Jesus' attention to what buildings? Specifically one, most likely. Yeah. The temple, which was known as what? There was Solomon's temple before. This was known as Herod's temple. And I've taught you this all before, but the idea was that Herod was a terrible human being. But one of the things he did as a ruler that was really smart is Herod did things that made the people happy. And so Herod had just spent lots of money and many years rehabbing the temple. And it was beautiful. All the accounts are, it was just amazing what Herod did to the temple. All right. This is the temple that we'll talk about in a little bit that was destroyed in AD 70 by the Romans. But apparently the disciples come to Jesus in verse 1 and they call his attention to the buildings. Like, hey, Jesus, what's up? Check out the cool buildings. And Jesus responds with something very cryptic. He doesn't jump in. I'm like, oh, I like the architecture. No. Jesus says, do you see all these things? Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. And so, verse 3. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, Olivet Discourse, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved, and the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get their cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath, for there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you there he is out in the wilderness, do not go out, or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures gather. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds and from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken and the other left. Therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come in an hour when you do not expect him. So that's a lot of information. Let me just, curiosity, what did you hear? What is BC, Jesus' driving point in all this? And what's he talking about? And if you tell me, then I'll tell everybody else and take credit. Okay, be ready. Could be any time. What else? Yeah, so what happens in this passage is Jesus seems to have, he's zooming in and zooming out a lot, very fast, all right? And so he seems to, in one picture, have in mind the idea of AD 70, when the Romans destroyed the temple, knocked it down. That's when you see pictures of Jews at the Wailing Wall, that's what's left of that temple, it's gone. So in some of these things, you can read a sentence, you're like, oh, Jesus is clearly talking about AD 70 and what's going on there. And then at other moments, he seems to be talking about the coming of Messiah, or the coming, his second coming, or something out there, and he's fuzzy about that. And so we could work through the details. It's not important for us to work through those details this morning, but in this passage, Jesus is just think of it that way. He's zooming in to near future, it's AD 70, he's zooming out. So what we've passed to he's zooming into his near future, what is past to us, and then he's zooming out, what is future to him and to us. Does that make sense? All right? So back and forth, he's zooming in, zooming out. All right? But the point of this passage over and over again is you don't know. Verse 44, so you must also be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour that you do not expect. You don't know. And so despite the cottage industry of Christian books on the subject, you don't know. And I love to say, like, as soon as somebody says it's a particular date, I feel pretty confident that day that it's not that day, right? Like, oh, great, May 21st, 2011, I can just live wildly, right? Because it's not happening, kidding. But it's not happening then, by definition. So there's that. And so that's the setup then. And if you look at the big scope of Matthew 24 and 25, and just so you know, the next 3 weeks we're in Matthew chapter 25. That whole section there, that teaching, is the setup for a short story that starts at the end of 45 about a faithful and wise servant / foolish servant. And we're going to read that in just a minute. And then the parable of the 10 virgins, which Ted just read for us, and we'll read again together. And then next week's teaching, which is the parable of the bags of gold. And the week after that teaching, the parable of the sheep and goats. All of those stories, starting with the one we're going to read here in just a second, all four of those stories are built upon the idea of the Olivet Discourse, and you don't know when all of these things are going to happen. So whereas the disciples are really worked up about, hey, look at this beautiful building, and Jesus just said it's going to get knocked down, and when's that going to happen? Jesus is saying, you don't know when it's going to happen, so live like it's coming anytime. You just have to be ready because you don't know, and then tells these four stories to help them understand how to live in that space where you don't know. Is that helpful? All right? So that's the context. So let's read this first story and see what Jesus says, and then we're going to read the one that Ted read for us. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. Truly I tell you, he will put him in charge of all of his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time, and then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, said Jesus with a smile. That's a little weird there, by the way. The end of it, that he will cut him to pieces, little tiny pieces, and feed him to the sharks, right? So what's the tenor of this story? Besides the cut him to pieces part, what's Jesus saying about, how's he further fleshing out in this story this idea of you don't know, so be ready? What's he saying about that? With the wise and the foolish servant. Okay? To be diligent in your work. What else? Stay ready, because it may come when? In this story. Like now. In this story, let me point at the return of the pastor. So the setup of the story is this. He says there's two scenarios here. There's this master, and the master has to go out of town. And common to their culture, there would have been a servant who would have been over everybody else, kind of almost like not the co-owner of the family business, but really he knows everything that's going on. And so the idea of a person leaving and leaving everything to a servant would have been common to them, like that's what would happen. So one servant, in the first part of the story, this servant just keeps doing exactly as his master had left him to do, so that when the master returns, everything is just like I left it. In the other story, the master says, hey, the master's gone, and I can beat all my fellow servants, which we don't know why. That's why, it's just what he did. So he, what does it say? He beat them and then drank all the wine that was in the storage. Yeah, he beat the servants, and he eat and get drunk with drunkards. And then that master comes back early and finds him doing that, and then the cutting to pieces. And the emphasis of that story then is on the imminence, that this thing is going to happen. It could happen like tomorrow. What happens if he comes back tomorrow? Will he find you faithful? I don't know when it's happening, but if it comes right now, what are you doing right now? What are you doing with your life? How are you living it right this minute? Juxtaposed to that is this next story of the 10 virgins, and let's read it again together and then comment on it. At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish, and five were wise. The foolish ones took their lamps, but did not take any oil with them. The wise ones, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. The bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. At midnight, the cry rang out, "Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish ones said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out." "No," they replied, "there may not be enough for both us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves." But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others also came. "Lord, Lord," they said, "open the door for us." But he replied, "Truly I tell you, I don't know you. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour." So what are our questions, comments, things we don't understand about the parable of the 10 virgins? Yeah. So the analogy is to the party that's going on. Good. That's a good story. Yeah. They hoping, pick me. Yeah, I'll get to that in just a minute. Some of this has to do, we miss the context. And I'll take a minute, in just a minute, and kind of map out what's going on here. What else? Sounds like they're being punished for not being organized. Some of you relate to that, right? Like, they couldn't get their stuff together, and here it happens. Yeah. Oh, so you're saying that he's saying to those who waited to the last minute, like, tough, I don't know you. Okay? Right, right. You could have just mooched along and followed somebody that had a lamp and gone with them. All right, so let's talk details, all right? So in the medieval church, the way to do parables would have been complete 100% straight up allegory. So what we would have done this morning if we were part of the medieval church, and really nobody much does this anymore, is we would have said, what does oil represent? Good works, obviously. What do the virgins represent? They represent the 10 kingdoms of this blah, 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 blah. Like, we would go through every single detail in the story and talk about what's the lamp, what's sleep. Sleep is clearly death. You know, like, who's the party? Like, we would go through all of this and do allegories. And that's not the approach we're going to take this morning. We're going to talk about more about the context and what the big picture of what Jesus was trying to say. Spoiler alert, Jesus kind of just says it in verse 13, what he's about, like, what the... If you don't like to read the story and you just want to skip it and get to what he's saying, he says it, which is really hard to preach when he does that. So, context. Jesus is setting this up in terms of a wedding ceremony, all right? So, in their culture, something everybody would have understood. Now, we all understand, I hope, that not everyone in the world does weddings the same way we do. We know our wedding ceremonies, right? You know, everybody been to a wedding? Just not along, right? Everybody's been to a wedding. We know how it works. The bride wears white. She comes down. We sing, "Here Comes the Bride," which nobody does anymore, which means somebody will probably start doing it, to be ironic, soon. And then, you know, the whole way we do it, we all know. But some of us have had these experiences, and we took some time in the first service just to explore. Like, some people have been to Greek weddings, and then Marche's mom told about how she wore 3 dresses and 2 hairstyles and lit cigarettes for her father-in-law and all his friends. Doesn't look like American wedding, right? And depending on where you go in the world, we all know, like, we're all worldly enough to know this, that if you go to India to a wedding, it's not going to look like our weddings, right? Weddings look different in different cultures. And so in Jesus' time, weddings looked very different than they look today. And I want to say up front, the hard thing about these kind of parables is that Jesus is probably speaking this story in a specific village that has a specific kind of custom. In Jesus' time, if you take away internet and phones and television and all those things, the customs can vary not just from country to country, but from village to village. You can be in one village and, well, we always do it this way. And the next village is like, no, we always shatter a bottle of wine at the bride's feet to signify something. I don't know, like many children. You know, I don't know, like everybody has their own reasons for doing their things. Like, okay, for example, when I do weddings with couples, one of the big ones in our culture it's a nuance. But when couples light the unity candle, do you blow the individual candles out or do you leave them lit? And some mothers-in-law particularly have strong opinions about said blowing or not blowing out of the candle. Because on one side, people are like, no, you blow it out because your identity is lost and now the unity candle. And the other, and particularly the moms are like, but they're still my baby. Don't blow us out. And so it goes 50-50, right? And I always just give brides and grooms, here's your choice. You know, like, whatever you want to represent. It's not on my head. And so that's the thing, is wedding custom goes village to village all over the place. In general, here's how weddings would have worked in Jesus' time. And in general, this is the idea. Is that first, in a wedding process, there'd be a betrothal, all right? The men would have gotten together and would have said, your daughter, my son... Yeah, and they would have worked out a deal, a financial deal. There'd have been a whole thing to it, right? And so that would have been arranged, and he would have gone home and said to his son, son, I found you a real beauty, which I think we're all terrified by the idea of our fathers picking out spouses for us. And what would happen then is the groom then would go into a period of preparation. He would most likely have been then adding on space to his family residence. He would have been building on a room for his wife and family because eventually he'd have brought her back there. And so he would have gone about preparing. And so in the context of the Olivet Discourse, this makes a lot of sense, right? Because if you live in a small village and you see, you know everybody and you know there was this deal made and they're betrothed, and now you see the groom out building, like, you know, like, hey, they're putting on siding, they're putting on roofing, like, all right. And then you start noticing, like, hey, the painters were here today, and the plumbers just left, and, you know, they just installed cable TV, and so, you know, like, he must be getting close. Like, this thing is getting closer and closer, right? And that's what Jesus is talking about. Like, you see these signs, and don't work up about it, but eventually what would have happened in the culture is eventually they would have been ready, and the groom would have gone to his father and said, I'm ready. And a message would have gone from the groom's family to the bride's family to say, all right, we're ready, and here's the night the deal's going down. The ceremony itself would have happened at night. That's consistent with Jesus' story and what we know of Middle Eastern custom. Night could be anything. You know, if they lived in the Midwest, it'd be like 4:30 now. And so the procession, what would happen is the groom would have then gone to the bride's house. And when he got to the bride's house, he would have gone into her house, and he would have received her as his bride, and there would have been a ceremony done there that would have been private to the family, and sometimes his family as well. So there would have been a private ceremony there. Then, at some point, when that ceremony was done, and they were ready for the reception to go, instead of everybody driving off and going to Kmart in their tux because they have an hour and a half to kill while the photographer takes pictures, and we're just really hungry and want to get there and eat, instead of that happening, what they did is the groom and the bride now, they would have started a parade through town. And it would have been like the most circuitous route. This is not about efficiency. This is about wandering all the streets of the town because you're excited and you're inviting everybody in to the reception, to this party. It wouldn't have been by invite only. They would have just like, hey, we're excited. We're getting married. We are married. Come to the party. And so they would have wound their way through the city and eventually ended up back at the groom's house where the party would start. And this party could have lasted one night. It could have lasted as many as 7 nights, depending on the wealth of the family and the context and the customs of the village, but it could have been a long celebration. And some of you like, oh, the cost, right? So that's the context. So when Jesus talks about bridegroom, these virgins going out, that's the idea, is that they know that there's this wedding processional coming and they want to be part of this party. And so they're just waiting for the bride and groom to come. They know, the idea would have been that they know that the groom went to the bride's house. They know that this thing is starting to roll and they're waiting for it. But the point, it seems like the point that Jesus is trying to make is that in this case, unlike the last story, in this one, the coming is delayed. In the first story Jesus tells, remember, the master comes back unexpectedly and finds his servant beating his other servants and drinking and all those things. That's what he finds. In this story, he's not coming. And he's not coming, and he's not coming, and it gets delayed, and it's been a long time, and it goes on so long that eventually the brides, or the virgins, they fall asleep. Now, a couple things to note. Throughout classic interpretation of this event, going back all the way back in church history, a couple things are pointed out all the time. First of all, there's never any condemnation in the passage. Somebody in the first service pointed out, they asked, like, why didn't the five that had the oil just share their oil? Like, that seems antithetical to the way of Jesus. And we have to be careful in parables. We're only getting part of a story that, you know, Jesus is making up and using to tell a point. Maybe the other bridesmaids warned them in advance. Maybe, who knows what was happening? Maybe they were just really disorganized. You know, like, we don't know why they didn't. And it appears in the context of the story that the ones that do have oil only have enough for themselves. The reason for the lamps is, again, rooted in their custom, that it would have been unsafe in this culture, in this time. Women wouldn't have been out at night without some kind of escort, preferably, but then a light to show who they were. There was only one kind of woman who was off sneaking around in the dark, and if you weren't her, you were holding a light up to let everybody know who you were. So that would have been important to them in their culture to have that lamp. So, you know, again, if we go back to the Middle Ages, I'm sure there's some allegory for what the lamp represents. But it's just part of the culture. And so Jesus just uses that to set up this idea that some are ready and some are not. Which gets to the point of the story then. So the five go off to refill, and who knows where they're buying it in the middle of the night, most likely borrowing from people or whatever. Again, probably not the most important detail, but that the bridegroom in verse 10, but while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom finally arrives. And the bride and the party and the virgins who were ready went with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. And later the others came. Lord, Lord, they said, open the door for us. But he replied, truly I tell you, I don't know you. This is one of those points. I was reading this book this week on Middle Eastern custom, and it said one of the things through Middle, I think it's called The Bible Through Middle Eastern Eyes, and it said one of the things, if you read this through Middle Eastern eyes, Middle Easterners read this story, and they're like, oh, that's not how this story ended, though, because it's a hospitality shame culture, and the way they would read this story is, the way this story ends is, but he replied, I tell you, I never knew you. But come on in. Who cares if I don't know you? Like that in a hospitality culture, they would have just welcomed them all in anyway. But what Jesus is doing is Jesus is taking the story, and this story shows up, by the way, in different rabbinic teachings, and this is not an uncommon story, but the way Jesus is twisting it and telling it is that this story is about being ready. So most weeks when I'm preparing, I really hope that I can come in here and take a passage like this one and say, I know it appears that it looks like this, but trick of exegesis and Greek words and blah, 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 and historical context, ta-da, it really means this. And then I feel like a genius. And then I go home and try to parent my kids and realize I'm not. But this one, Jesus just tells us exactly what this parable is about, right? So verse 13, it's really explicit. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour. Five times in these two chapters, by the way, five times Jesus reminds them, you do not know the day or the hour. It comes up, you can count them, there's five of them in there where he points out that, again, you don't know the day or the hour. And so the theme of all four of these stories, the two that I'm talking about today and then the two we're going to talk about in the next 2 weeks, are about being ready. And I'm going to, in one sense, set the ball on the tee for the next 2 weeks and say, the next 2 weeks we're going to talk about specifically what does it mean to live in this delayed thing, right? And we're going to talk specifically about what does it mean to be ready. In fact, this week when I was prepping this, I started working down that road, and then I looked ahead and I was like, ooh, can't steal thunder from the other places. So then I got to looking at this passage and started thinking about what this story in particular is saying. And what this story is talking about is what it means to follow Jesus in the long haul. I had somebody come up after the service and say, you know, I'm always telling myself that this thing of following Jesus, it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's a long haul. I'm 40, and I hope this is the halfway point or less, right? Like, it's a long haul. I've been following Jesus for a long time, and things have changed, and I've changed, but it's a really long haul. I tell couples in premarital counseling all the time that the trick is not to pull off a wedding. Like, doing a wedding, yeah, there's a lot of logistics, and congratulations, your invites were a little bit more creative than the other person's. Well done. We're all duly impressed. But that doesn't make a great marriage. A marriage takes, like, a lot of long haul kind of thinking. Jennifer and I got married 18 and a half years ago. I was 22 and she was 21, and that feels so young these days. And one of the great things about marrying somebody young is that we look back now, we say this all the time to each other, like, we are not the same people we were at 22 and 21. That we have learned who we are through each other a lot, you know, and we've grown together. And I kind of joked, but I don't know if it's even a joke, that if 40-year-old Charlie met 21-year-old Jennifer, I'd still be attracted to her because she looks the same, by the way, that she did like when we were 20. So I'd still be attracted to her, but like when I got to know her, like I don't think we'd be a fit. And if 40-year-old Jennifer met 22-year-old Charlie, she wouldn't give me the time of day, right? And what the journey is almost 20 years into marriage, is the journey is one of us growing together and becoming together. And we're each becoming something different in ourselves, and we keep trying to find ways to keep falling in love with the person that I'm married to. And that, to me, is what the long haul looks like. The long haul looks like, as I grow in this journey with God, the things I thought about God even 20 years ago are so different than the things I thought about God today. And the ways I think about me are so different than the ways I think about me. And this long haul, this staying up through the night until you fall asleep kind of Christianity, that thing, that's what it looks like. It's continuing to go on journeys of understanding me and understanding God and keep finding ways to keep following God as I'm doing that. The challenge is, I think that in our culture where we get everything fast, a lot of us think that we're doing, you know, those puzzles that you do with your like 1 year old, where it's a puzzle of a truck, and the puzzle is a truck with a little handle on it, and you put it in, and I'm a genius, right? That's not what this is. I have a friend who loves to do puzzles, and I tried to help her once when we were at their house, and I lasted like 5 minutes because I hate puzzles. They're dumb. You can buy the picture, all right? So, and I know some of you love puzzles. But this life that we're doing, this marriage that I'm doing, this following after Jesus that I'm doing, it is not a 10-piece kid's puzzle. It's 1,000-piece jigsaw, right? And so figuring this thing out is not, there's no quick fixes. If you think that following after Jesus means that you have an idea or a problem and then you come to the pastor's office and have a meeting and then you're all fixed, you've got the wrong pastor, first of all. And that's just not how it works. And if you think that you have this problem and this thing in your life and you don't know what to do with it and you can read one book and read that book and then everything's solved, you don't understand what it means to do long-haul Christianity, what it means to follow after Jesus for a long haul. I was reading, if you've been in my office in the last couple of months, I've had something written up on my board that's been sitting there for a long time and just thinking a lot about. I read a book 2 months ago, I think, by a guy named Marcus Borg called Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. He's even in our congregation, he would be way out to the left, right? Pretty like liberal, not as a, I'm not calling him names, just as a scholar. He's really liberal. But he talks about this idea about the journey for all of us in faith. And he says that we all start with this place, at this place of pre-critical naivety, is what he calls it. And the idea of pre-critical naivety is you believe everything that you're told because you're five, right? And so when somebody tells you that when you lose a tooth, somebody sneaks into your house, like, you believe that. Like, that's just, and when somebody tells you that there was a slingshot and a giant died and there was a flood that covered the whole earth, you believe every detail of those stories because that's the way your mom and dad said it happened. He says at some point then, usually always involuntarily, but usually in our teenage years, we start going through critical thinking where we start asking like, what? Like, who sneaks down what and leaves presents? Like, what? That really happens? Like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so we start, and if you have kids, this is fun, by the way. It's fun to watch the lights come on. Like, Jennifer and I laugh about some of the ways that they start critical thinking. Like, wait a minute. Why does the tooth fairy always come after breakfast in the mornings? There's a good reason for that, because people are forgetful. That's not even kidding. It happens. One of our kids thinks the tooth fairy comes while they're eating breakfast every morning. not very good parents. So critical thinking is a period where we start asking all the hard questions. And what's funny is we often think we're the only person who's ever asked these questions before, right? Like, I can't believe this. And we start, and people around us that are maybe still in pre-critical naivety or some other thing, like they think we're crazy because they're like, what? Stop asking questions. Stop being annoying. You know, like stop upsetting the boat. But we can't help ourselves. There's just something in us that drives us to ask hard questions and to get answers. And Borg says that then we go to another place, and this is where we have a choice, is the healthy progression is what he calls post-critical naivety. And so he talks about post-critical naivety as a place where we can see the stories and understand that while they may not be factual, they're still true. And so, for example, let me talk about the tortoise and the hare. When you're 5 years old you hear the story of the tortoise and the hare, you actually think that there was a tortoise and there was a hare and they agreed to a race. You think that they spoke to one another and worked it out, and there was a day where tortoise and hare raced each other. And at some point, critical thinking took over, probably about 6 years old, right? When you started waiting, like, wait a minute, rabbits don't talk to turtles. Rabbits only talk to rabbits. Critical thinking is sometimes fuzzy. And you realize it wasn't really a race. But then at some point in your life, you move to a place of post-critical naivety where you realize that it didn't actually factually happen that the tortoise and hare had a race, but it's true. Slow and steady wins the race. I didn't mean to rhyme that, but you realize it's true. Now, I know that not all of you agree with this. Borg does that to Bible stories. That's how he understands scriptures. And we don't need to quibble about that this morning, but that many of us work through this journey of faith. And what I want to talk about for just a minute this morning as we wrap up is this middle space called critical thinking. Another word that we use around here a lot is deconstruction. That part of this thousand puzzle journey is deconstruction. Have you ever opened a puzzle box and somebody else did the puzzle and they left, like, to clean up the puzzle, they just folded it a bunch of times and threw it in the box? So, like, a bunch of the pieces are already together. Now, to somebody like me, ka-ching, right? So half the work's already done. But to you purists, the first thing you do is you deconstruct it, right? You take all the pieces apart. You make sure everything's separated out. And then you start putting it together eventually. Deconstruction is that phase where we look at our lives growing up and we say, people told me this about God and I don't believe this about God anymore. People told me this about the Bible and church and this and that and this thing, and I don't believe that anymore. And that's a healthy part of a long-haul journey. I want you to hear this. That's part of the journey. I tell people with parenting is that one of the things that's going to happen, starting to happen with our boys, is as they grow up, I want to be the strong boards that our kids can kick against, that they can do that, that they can deconstruct and say, Dad, I don't believe in your religion, and I can be strong enough to take that and help them in their journey and not lose my mind in the process. You know, that's the harder part. I guess that's the part I'll work on, is not losing my mind, but that I want to do that with them. I don't want to be so rigid that they don't want to punch against me anymore, but I don't want to be so giving that I don't give them feedback. It's finding that right tension. And so that's part of the journey, is this deconstruction. But the danger, and Borg says this, is that the danger of critical thinking is it can be, long-term, a really, really dark place. I call it, in my office, I have it drawn out, I call it the cynic's spiral, right? That we get into this spiral where we don't want to believe anything and we're critical about everything and we find ourselves just instinctively cynical. Somebody opens their mouth and because they don't look like us or they're not of our generation or our age or they don't like the authors I like, we instantly are cynical because it's our posture. And it's not just a healthy season in the long haul journey, but that's become the destination, is cynicism. And one of the things I've personally been thinking about the last couple years, let me say this now. I want to share something I talked about with somebody between services. Is moving beyond this season of deconstruction and move to this place of post-critical. Like, not only this is what I'm against, but this is what I'm for. And I think that what we need to understand is when we do that, the puzzle that we tore apart over here, what we find is somehow in the middle, it's not the same puzzle we're putting back together again the next time. But you start the same way. You start by, you know, finding all the corners, finding the straight edges, and working from there, right? I think that's the way everybody does puzzles. It's the way I do puzzles. You know, when you got 10 pieces to work with, you really got to get your edges perfect so you can put that one in the middle. But that's the journey. And many of us, I just really, us, Mago Day Church, with me as the ringleader, it's easy for us to be cynics, isn't it? Because we're young and we see things differently than our parents or whatever. And if we're not actually young, we're young in spirit. Like I tell people sometimes outside of here, we have some older people in our church, but they're all like 30-year-olds in their heads. So we're all really immature, right? So, and some of it in our immaturity is we too easily live in cynicism. And the invitation this morning is really simple, is to move out of that. To take steps in your journey of saying, I don't know what the whole puzzle is, but here's an edge. I know I don't think this about the Bible anymore. It's not a rule book to beat people up with. And I don't even know exactly what it is, but I know that it's this, whatever those things are. And so the invitation this morning is what are you for? What am I for? And maybe the conversations, Jennifer and I are having some of these conversations in our family, like her and I, like, what are we for? It's not enough to be against. It's not enough to, that doesn't get you long haul. That doesn't get you, you don't get there by saying, these are the marriages I can't stand, right? You need to do a little bit of that. You know, sometimes you have suppers for six and people leave and you're like, thank God I don't have that marriage. Like, sometimes you do that because that's part of defining. But at the end of the day, you have to answer the question, like, what am I really about? Who are we? What are we about? And so I think in this parable, the reminder from Jesus is the delay may be long. It may be a long night before Jesus comes back, and we may journey with Jesus a very long time. This thing isn't 10 pieces, it's 1,000. And what are you for? Let's pray. God, at times I've lived in a very cynical place for a long period of time, and I know that that's not healthy in the long run, in the marathon journey, in the 1,000-piece puzzle, in the long haul. It's just not, we can't live there. And so God, help us as individuals to work through those places. And we all have them and we'll continue to have them, of those places where it's hard and we're going to work through the cynicism, but then help us to actually work through it and to come out on the other side. Help us in this body to spur one another on to love and good works, to find things that we're for, that we can encourage each other into, so that we can keep following you for the long haul. In your name I pray. Amen.